Welcome back to PedScript. I'm Zach Hodges, a pediatric ICU fellow from UT Southwestern in Dallas.
And I'm Alice Shanklin, a critical care fellow at Children's National in Washington, D.C.
So we have a very exciting topic today. Alice, what do we have?
Yes, today we are talking to Dr. Alexis Topchin, and we are talking about post-cardiac arrest care. Unfortunately, this is the backbone of pediatric ICU medicine and something that we see a lot. And so I'm excited that you've been able to recruit her to tell us how to do it well.
Yes, certainly a very relevant topic. Dr. Topchin is a professor of anesthesiology and critical care at the University of Pennsylvania. She's an intensivist at CHOP, and she's a post-cardiac arrest researcher. In addition to all of her research in post-cardiac arrest care, she is the first author of the 2019 Pediatric Post-Cardiac Arrest Care Scientific Statement from the American Heart Association. It's great to have her on the show.
Yes, this is such a great episode.
Something that we've referenced earlier is cooling or targeted temperature management. I'd like to unpack that now. Tell us what it is, maybe the practice patterns that's out there about targeted temperature management in these kids, and maybe get into what's your practice.
Sure. So this could be a podcast in and of itself. Mm-hmm. Cooling, and I'm going to focus mostly on pediatrics because we have some of our own data. But I think, as people know, there were some adult cooling trials early on in the early 2000s. That really brought the thought of targeted temperature management to 33 degrees to the forefront as potentially improving outcomes, especially after VF arrest. And that's where those early studies were done. The two more recent trials, the TTM and TTM2 trial in adults, have really shown no difference in outcomes in patients who are treated with TTM to 33 degrees and TTM either to 36 degrees or just active monitoring for fever and then treating when it comes. But for pediatrics, we have the FAFCA trials that came out in 2000 and, I can't remember the years now. It's been a while.
Hey, everyone. This is Zach here in post. So the FAFCA trial, or Therapeutic Hypothermia After Out-of-Hospital Cardiac Arrest in Children, by Frank Moeller et al., was published in the New England Journal of Medicine on May 14th in 2015. As Dr. Topchin is about to get into, this was a large trial of two targeted temperature interventions at 38 children's hospitals, involving children who remained unconscious after out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. These patients were randomized to receive either therapeutic hypothermia at 33 degrees Celsius or therapeutic normothermia at 36.8 degrees Celsius. The primary outcome was survival at 12 months after cardiac arrest. There was also a therapeutic hypothermia after in-hospital cardiac arrest in children trial that was published approximately 2 years later on January 26, 2017 in the New England Journal. Had the same methods, but they looked at children who had an in-hospital cardiac arrest, and Dr. Topchin will detail this further. You can find references to both of these trials in our show notes. And with that, let's get right back to our conversation with Dr. Topchin.
But when the FAFCA trials were published, one was for out-of-hospital and one was for in-hospital. And those two trials were randomized controlled trials comparing 48 hours of either 33 degrees to 36.8 degrees, then looking at a one-year outcome based on the Vineland Adaptive Behavioral Score, so a neurobehavioral outcome at a year. And the studies were actually interesting. They were done at the same time, but they were analyzed separately because the cause of arrest and the arrests are very different. So I'll start by saying the in-hospital trial, it was stopped early. There was truly no difference between the groups, no signal whatsoever. I think that really flavored a lot of people's thoughts about cooling in hospital. I'll say I think a lot of centers that cooled before probably still do, and a lot of centers that did not don't. Because the trial did not show that one was worse or one was better. It showed that there was no difference. The FAFCA out-of-hospital trial was actually really interesting and really has raised a lot of question and sort of consternation. And that's because while the p-value for that study was non-significant at 0.12, 20% of the patients that were in the 33-degree arm had a favorable outcome, and only 12% in the normothermia arm had a favorable outcome. And so afterwards, people said, well, was it underpowered? Was 48 hours really the right duration? What did we do in study design? Because it seems like maybe for these out-of-hospital patients, there's a signal. Did we include kids that were too sick? Did we include kids that could have been sort of injured, but a little less severely injured? Like, who really might benefit from that? It was very interesting. I think when the out-of-hospital trial came out, people really fell into two camps, right? Clearly, the study didn't show us what we needed to see. Was underpowered, we should be cooling out-of-hospital arrest. And then the other camp who said, clearly the study is a negative trial, we should not be cooling anybody. And I think when you look at the practice that ensued in the decade after those trials came out, most pediatric centers said, you know what, no difference, targeted temperature management, target normothermia, and we are going to just prevent fever, but there's no difference. And let's be honest, TTM to 36.8 degrees seems a lot easier than TTM to 33. Mm-hmm. And I think in general, that's probably the practice that's been out there. What we did here, which is a little bit different, is we said, well, we're a pretty large practice group. And the in-hospital, everybody agreed there was no difference and normothermia was easy. And so we did that. But within the group, there were people who said, I would cool to 33 degrees because I actually think that the study tells me that there's a signal and we haven't found it yet. And so what we did is we created a pathway for out-of-hospital arrest where our provider, the attending on, the clinical team on, actually can decide what they want to do. Do you want to cool to 33 or do you want to cool to 36.8 after out-of-hospital cardiac arrest? And while I think most of my partners will cool to 36.8, there are a group that select 33 degrees for those patients after cardiac arrest because they believe that impacts outcome. I do think it's really important to note that in those TTM trials and in the care that we provide, cooling is only one piece of what we do. So there's a whole bundle of care in those trials that really goes into place when these people are treated on study. So the things we've talked about, oxygenation, ventilation, blood pressure management, not performing early neuroprognostication. And so one of the questions we ask is like, what's the bundle that you apply? It's not just a temperature, right? But it's really thoughtful post-arrest management. And so we're very thoughtful, no matter what temperature arm you're in, that you're going to get a whole bundle of care, not just a temperature arm.
That's really helpful. And gosh, that's one of the complexities about these patients' care is that we have all this data. It's really unclear exactly which direction is best for this patient. It seems that the safest thing to do is to target this 36.8 because it's easy to manage that. We think we can maintain that carefully. You mentioned cooling to 36.8. That makes me seem like it's a very active process. We're doing things to make sure this patient stays 36.8. Will you tell us what that looks like in your practice?
Yes. So for every out-of-hospital cardiac arrest that we have coming in, we have a room set up. So what we have when the patient rolls in is if we're using our Blanketrol, we've got the blanket on the bed with the machine in the room when the kid rolls in. We're using the Arctic Sun, we've got the machine in the room. But we have a plan before that patient comes in that a temp probe goes in and the machine gets turned on. We do that because we know that patients get febrile. We had one just recently where we had a really hard time actually breaking fever. Mm-hmm. And so from our practice standpoint, we anticipate and we're prepared when the patient comes in with whichever arm we're going to use. We also use IV Tylenol as an antipyretic, and we do that up front in order to minimize the risk of fever. And so we anticipate, we prepare, and that's just the standard for all of our patients. You can always peel back, but what we try and avoid is being 6 hours in and saying, hey, did anybody find that blanket? We got so busy. Mm-hmm. Oh, we're putting a line in, the kid was sterilely prepped. We never got it set up, and now his temperature is 38.5 degrees. So we had the room set up before the kid comes in.
Nice.
So one last question about TTM. I don't have the opportunity to take care of many patients who are cooled. It's just not something that we do very often in our center. Are there any clinical pearls that you'd like to share with us and our listeners about managing these patients who are cooled? Certainly their physiology changes, and there's different things with their monitoring modalities.
Yeah. So I think we think about TTM in sort of three phases. There's the induction phase when you're dropping temperature, potentially from a normal temperature to a lower temperature. The maintenance phase when you're holding, and then the rewarming phase. The induction phase when you drop temperature, we like to drop as quickly as possible because we think the faster you're cold, if it's going to benefit you, the better. But with that, you'll see some sort of known physiologic side effects. You're going to see a drop in heart rate, which makes sense. You're metabolically cool. And with that, you're also going to see an increase in your systemic vascular resistance. So I always like to have my lines in, at least my arterial line in, as soon as possible, because it gets harder to put those in once you're peripherally vasoconstricted. As you shrink the vascular tank and you have return of blood back to the right heart, you're going to see an increase in your preload and you'll see what we call a cold diuresis. So you get more urine output. And that's just not surprising, right? You're shrinking your tank and that's going to happen. You can also see insulin resistance. So cooling causes insulin resistance, and as a result, you will see some hyperglycemia that leads to more diuresis. And you can see some intracellular shifts of potassium into the cell. So you can also see some associated sort of hypokalemia. And those things are all really sort of normal and expected as long as you're in the 32 to 34 range. But you have to anticipate that they're coming and be prepared to deal with them so that you're ready to treat your hyperglycemia with some insulin. If you're having urine output, I usually have K in my fluids. We assess our labs a little bit more frequently, usually every 4 to 6 hours, electrolytes specifically to make sure that you stay on top of your calcium and your potassium and minimize the risk for arrhythmia. One of the nice things about cooling is because it increases your SVR, it can actually be a little bit of a vasopressor, right? So it can actually give you some vasoconstriction and help your blood pressure a little bit. So that's sort of what we expect during induction. And there's some very nice sort of physiologic cooling papers out there that people can use for reference to guide and sort of inform as you think through this. The maintenance phase is a pretty chill time, no pun intended. It's really sort of keeping patients where they are. And you know, during all this time, you're dealing with a post-arrest syndrome, right? So you may have other ongoing ARDS from the cardiac arrest. You could have ongoing arrhythmias. Hypotension is common because all of the post-arrest syndrome sort of persists through cooling. But during the maintenance phase, because you're holding steady at temperature, you may, depending upon the device you see some fluctuations or swing in temperature. But really, you're just sort of holding steady, monitoring, and being aware that you're not going to see a fever necessarily if there's a new infection. So you've got to have that on your radar. You may see a small bump in your lactate from cooling, and that's usually, you know, from 1.5 to 3. That's not a lactate of 7, 8, or 9. Mm-hmm. You may see a small bump in your amylase and lipase, and that's not unexpected either. There is some data that you may see a prolonged bleeding time as well, although you tend at 32 to 34 not to see clinically significant bleeding due to the cooling itself. And that's really been looked at in trials that have compared both arms. And the big question then is, how long do you cool for? And that is unknown. And then the rewarming phase. So I actually think the rewarming phase is potentially the rockiest phase, because you're taking a patient who has had a cardiac arrest, and now you're going to vasodilate them. So you're going to rise your heart rate, very expected, but the tank is going to get bigger. And so it is not uncommon to see some decreased urine output, a decreased CVP, and require giving fluids and potentially sometimes even a little bit of vasopressor to help the tank dilate a little bit more slowly. We like to rewarm slowly to minimize the risks of that, but it's a transition time in physiology. And I should say, additionally, all that potassium that's shifted into your cells, it's probably going to come on out. So if you are on very, very high amounts of intravenous potassium during the maintenance phase, we usually pull our K out in anticipation that you're going to have some cellular shifts. Likewise, that insulin resistance gets better. So you may anticipate that you could have a little bit of a drop in your blood sugar. So ongoing monitoring, just like induction, we monitor very closely. During warming, we do the same. And really, in anticipating what is going to happen, usually can sort of manage through those relatively well.
Oh, nice. When you talk about doing it slowly, is this a slow titration of your Blanketrol temperature, or is this something else?
No, slow titration of your Blanketrol temperature. So depending upon the device you use, there are different ways to do this. If you're using the Blanketrol, we increase our temperature every 4 hours or so by 0.7 degrees. And if you're using a different device like the Arctic Sun, then you're going to set the temperature and rewarm slowly. And that does that slightly differently. But gradual rewarming, we usually do it over 16 to 24 hours, realizing if you have a lot of hemodynamic instability, you can just pause and take a moment. Mm-hmm. And I think thinking through that as both the clinician, as well as, you know, people who are more accustomed to cooling, working together to think about what makes the most sense for this patient. Do I need to rewarm them because I've got a concern about cooling? Or is this just a planned rewarming, and so we can just take our time and want to make sure we do this as safely as possible?
Oh, nice.
And one quick follow-up question, just to get a context. Would you say it's most common for kids to be cooled for around 48 hours? But I would like to know what's most common, maybe what the range is in practice.
Yeah, so I think a lot of places are not cooling. So there may not be a most common. The FATCA trials did 48 hours, and I think that has really guided a lot of people, right? We know neonates get 72, adults are closer to 24, FATCA did 48. When you look at ILCOR and AHA guidance, what they're going to tell you is because there have been no trials comparing durations of cooling, we actually don't know the optimal duration of cooling. We've got three different populations that get three different durations. In pediatrics, we haven't had a comparison. In the adults, they have had a small trial looking at different durations of cooling. So the answer is we don't really know, but I think most people default to FATCA and use about 48.
Nice. And I want to mention here, your CHOP pathway. Now, also at Children's National, we look at the CHOP pathways often. We think they're very educational, but you have a minimum lab schedule linked in here. It's very, I feel like it's good guidelines if someone is doing this.
Yeah.
Not a guideline, but maybe a clinical, like just
it's a clinical pathway. I think it's, you know, it's information you can take. We also, and I would advocate if you're building a system, we have a clinical order set with an Epic that we actually parallels that. So if you have an out of cardiac arrest on what we call our severe arm, you click a button and that rolls out all the orders and the things you want to have on call, right? The pressor's on call, the fluid's on call, a lab set, antibiotics if they're appropriate, EEG. So we've done that for decision support because in any of these centers, and you guys are both big centers, right? Lots of people take care of these patients and trying to establish some consistency in care so our patients get the same standard is something that we strive towards. And so these clinical pathways and these order sets can really be supportive of trying to do that.
Nice.
Great. Our next question is really one of the most important parts of this whole process of taking care of these kids who are post-cardiac arrest, and that's neuroprognostication. I'd like to know what factors stand out to you the most that speak, I guess, most heavily to our patients' outcomes, and how do you communicate these to the family? And really, I wanted to get into timing and maybe some other best practices.
You know, we all as clinicians at the bedside have like a gut feeling when a kid comes in. And I think a lot of times our gut feelings are wrong. We know that early prognostication can be associated with outcomes. We know that withdrawal of life-sustaining therapies are common. And so I would just sort of call out to people that we really need to be very thoughtful in terms of our own internal predictions and how that influences the care that we provide when we just don't know. Now, there are kids that are going to come in diabetes insipidus or have had 60-minute downtimes, you know, with cerebral edema. Mm-hmm. And those are not the patients I'm talking about. But we're all influenced by, I think, our own biases and experience in terms of how we think patients are going to do. And post-arrest care is a treatment. So we want to give most of our patients the ability to be treated and give them a chance for an outcome. So I will first say, try to avoid too early neuroprognostication is really important. We want to think about maybe stratifying injury and tailoring treatment, but not making a decision for many patients in that first 24 hours, 48 hours of what's going to happen. 72 hours, I think, is where a lot of us start thinking about where this is going. Multimodal monitoring can be helpful. So you may have data about the EEG background. You may have a neurologic exam at that point. You may have some of those pre-arrest factors, which do make a difference, right? Was it an unwitnessed out-of-hospital cardiac arrest for 45 minutes? Or was it like our first patient, right? A 12-year-old that was witnessed, went down, got immediate high-quality CPR and shocked. That may be really different. We all sort of mix all these factors in our minds, and thinking those through is really important. But acknowledging that the most reliable thing you have for neuroprognostication is actually what your patient's going to look like probably 5 days out, right? Mm-hmm. So I use those factors to think through things, but I always have to check myself to not let my own biases get in the way. We really highly value our neurologists, and I think neuroimaging is really helpful, looking at how much hypoxic ischemic brain injury we have. But what we really need to do is look at our patients. So I think using all of these factors is important, but cautioning ourselves not to get ahead of ourselves. What do you communicate with families? We walk a really fine balance of wanting to be straightforward and preparing our families without influencing them if we're unsure. And so I think, you know, we're oftentimes honest with our families. I'm really concerned. Some of these things are very concerning. We're going to do these treatments for the next 3 days, and then we're going to get some more information, right? We'll say our neurologists are going to see your child. We're going to get a brain MRI, but I'm worried because your child came in with signs of brain injury that I'm not sure what the outcome is going to be. And I think you have to sort of embrace not being sure and then knowing that there are times where you're going to pivot, right? There's signs of herniation. That's a really different story. Or, hey, you know what? I'm really surprised. Your son just opened his eyes and that was unexpected. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a fair amount to do in neuroprognostication. I think we have to be very careful, especially when patients are sedated and have been cooled, that residual sedation may be on board, that you can't really neuroprognosticate effectively when someone's cold. And just being really thoughtful that giving patients time and really assessing all the factors to be accurate is important.
Sure. I feel like communicating these very sensitive conversations to families in these terrible situations where the future is really not clear is one of the most important things we do as intensivists. It does feel right that around day 3 to day 5 seems to be about the right spot to start having conversations with families. A follow-up question, I imagine if you cool a patient to 33, that's only going to delay things for 48 to 72 more hours. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I think if you cool patients for 48 hours and then rewarm them and you're on sedatives, that should delay things because your clinical exam may be influenced by residual sedation and cooling. But I think oftentimes you have to ask yourself, besides wanting an answer, you want an accurate answer, right? Not an earlier answer. So it's a reasonable time around, you know, 4 days, 5 days, you go get your brain MRI, and then you incorporate all that information. You may wean your sedation. And then having a multidisciplinary approach to incorporating that and sharing that with the family is important. I think, you know, it's also important to know that when you look at some of the patients in the FACA trials, outcomes changed between, for some patients, some got better and some got worse between discharge and that first year. So most of our studies and how we think is, what's this kid going to look like on discharge? But we know that kids go on to develop over time. And one of the big questions that is out there is, how do children change after their cardiac arrest in the months and years afterward? And will some catch up on milestones? Do some plateau? Or do some deteriorate? And so what we see may not be what we get at hospital discharge. And it's something that I think we need to remember. And it's an area of sort of ongoing work to figure out what are the long-term developmental milestones we're going to see in these children. And I don't think we know quite yet.
Nice. Sure.
Now, you've mentioned this a little bit, but what do you really consider to be the next steps in this field?
Oh, so there's a lot of exciting things out there. So I think, as you guys know, the PICCAP trial is currently underway. It is an NIH-funded trial currently at 40 centers in the U.S., hoping to grow, evaluating the optimal duration of cooling to 33 degrees. So comparing what will eventually be 10 arms from no additional cooling at 0 hours. It'll eventually compare 10 arms, so 0 additional hours of cooling, out through 96 hours of cooling, 120-hour intervention in total. And the primary outcome is the Vineland adaptive behavioral score with composited with mortality. But it's really trying to get at, is there an optimal duration of cooling where we see a benefit? So you want to find the shortest duration that you see the benefit, and we're just not sure where that's going to be. So that's what that trial is going to be answering. That's going to hopefully enroll 900 kids over the next 5 years. And it's not only going to address that question, but really give us the opportunity to ask additional questions in this cohort. So hopes to look at, what are the long-term outcomes in the years afterwards? What does the EEG look like? What are the serum biomarkers and how do they trend over time? A number of questions and a huge opportunity, I think, for our field to really look at not only a therapeutic, but guide post-arrest care. And so I think that's incredibly exciting. I think there's a lot of really exciting work happening in the biomarker space and the neuroimaging space to think about prognostication and guidance. So really, how do we look at some of these brain biomarkers? How do we look at our MRIs? How do we incorporate that into our prognostication or targeting our treatments? Can we tailor treatments to some of these monitoring modalities? And likewise, I think there's some exciting work looking at cerebral autoregulation. And instead of taking this one-size-fits-all approach to, hey, we should just target a blood pressure of X, how do we look at the individual patient and their cerebral physiology and determine what should we be targeting to? So really personalization over time and coming up with therapeutics that will improve outcomes. So these are just a handful of things that are on the forefront.
Oh, wow. That's really exciting, especially the PICCAP enrollment. That's so important in such a big study.
Yeah, and we're always looking for sites. And I think there's sites, right, who have trainees. This is a great thing as a trainee. If you're a site, talk to your PI and see how you can be involved, how you can learn, how you can be a support team. It's a really great opportunity to understand the physiology and be part of research and potentially, you know, influence care and outcomes down the road. That's how I got started. So pretty exciting.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's so great that we get to share this with listeners all across the United States and I guess even around the world. So I guess feel free to reach out, right?
Yep.
Dr. Topshin, this has been a great conversation. Unfortunately, cardiac arrest is pretty common, and we see patients like this almost every day in the ICU. Very clinically relevant. I've learned so much. I know our listeners will as well. One last open-ended question. Anything else that you'd like to mention before we go? This, you can plug anything that you'd like or perhaps reinforce a couple key points.
Yeah, so I think what I would say to everyone who's listening, like all the work that we've done here was very sort of grassroots, right? It was a fellow, it was a junior attending, working with a nurse and a respiratory therapist saying like, you know what, we can do this better. We should build a system to do this. And building a system really just takes a couple of interested people to get started. So whether it's bringing in a cooling device or building a temperature pathway or putting in an order set, find your key stakeholders and think about how you can drive care and make care better. Because that's why we're all doing this. And it just takes a little bit of investment and, you know, a little bit of elbow grease. But you can put some of these systems and pathways in place. And the hope is, you know, with that and guiding your colleagues in terms of how to care for these patients, you can make a difference in their outcomes.
Oh, well, that is awesome. Dr. Topshin, thank you so much for joining us today.
It has been my pleasure.
And thank you for listening to this episode of Pete's Crit. Please remember that all content during this episode is intended for informational and educational purposes only. It should not be used as replacement for medical advice. The views expressed during this episode by hosts and our guests are their own and do not reflect the official position of their institutions. If you have any comments, suggestions, or feedback, you can email us at pedsgritpodcast@gmail.com or find us on Twitter @gritpeds and @pedsgrit on Instagram for real-time show updates. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review in your favorite podcasting application and share with your colleagues. Also, if you'd like to support the making of the podcast, please see the description for Venmo information and how to become a Patreon. Any donation will be appreciated. Thank you again for listening, and goodbye.
Zach, I have to tell you something. Can I tell you about what I was thinking about when you gave us the case?
Yeah, let's hear about that.
So, as you may or may not know, the Children's National PICU Fellows are unfortunately tasked with traveling via helicopter or ambulance to a select number of these transports.
Anything interesting about these transports?
Well, if it's automatically an alpha transport, which means that a fellow goes if it's a post-arrest patient. It's the restricted airspace above Washington, D.C., but we are allowed to fly in it.
Sounds pretty important.
It's the coolest thing I've ever done.
It's a bit of a selling point for the program.
Listen, this is something that we offer that nobody else offers, I will say.
Well, flying in the airspace above Washington, D.C., why not go? It sounds pretty
exciting.
Highly
recommend.
Perfect.
Nice. Thanks for doing that.
You got it.